I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday Friday. The Anne Arundel County Executive wants to prohibit medical marijuana in his county in the face of a state law that would allow it. We'll go over that story with a doctor and Maryland legislator who pushed for legalization. A prominent Baltimore preacher says he's running for the congressional seat now held by Elijah Cummings. But will the Reverend Jamal Bryant challenge Cummings if he runs for re-election? WIPR senior news analyst C. Frazier Smith helps us sort that story out. We have the weekly business report from the Baltimore Business Journal, Chris Reed's film reviews, and Paula Gallagher tells us about a unique book that shows what it's like behind the scenes of popular NPR shows like Planet Money and Radio Lab. It's Midday Friday, after the news from NPR. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Midday Friday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for being with us and making Midday part of your day. Ahead in this hour, film critic Christopher Llewellyn Reed joins us. He has two reviews and maybe a third. Everest is one of the films Chris will be talking about, the story of an expedition to Mount Everest that turned disastrous in 1996. And then there's a Whitey Bulger film about the Boston mobster Whitey Bulger called Black Mass that's out. Chris will be reviewing that. Baltimore County librarian Paula Gallagher joins us this time to tell us about some really interesting books that are featured this weekend at the Small Press Expo in Bethesda. These are graphic novels or nonfiction works by artists, and one of them is a sort of graphic novel treatment of popular NPR shows like Planet Money and Radio Lab, where the artist actually visited those shows and describes through drawings what happens there. So you might get a kick out of that. We'll also speak with State Delegate Dan Morheim about a pushback this week from Anne Arundel County Executive Steve Hsu over the growing and distribution of medical marijuana in his county. As you know, that's legal in the state of Maryland now, but Steve Hsu, the Anne Arundel County Executive, has proposed banning the growing, processing, and dispensing of medical marijuana in Anne Arundel County. We'll talk to Delegate Dan Morheim about that. Rick Seltzer has the weekly business report from the Baltimore Business Journal. And Frazier Smith is here with me today, WIPR's senior news analyst to start the show off and Daily Record columnist. Nice to have you on the show, Frazier.
Good to be with you, Dan, as always.
We'll talk some politics with you here in the early going, if you don't mind.
Not at all.
It was an interesting week. So on Monday, or overnight Sunday into Monday, there's this kind of big news that a very well-known preacher in Baltimore, the Reverend Jamal Bryant of Empowerment Temple, who came to real prominence during the demonstrations and protests first in Ferguson and then after the death of Freddie Gray here in Baltimore, had announced that he's going to run for the congressional seat currently held by Elijah Cummings, which surprised a lot of people. Here's the announcement from Jamal Bryant.
I wanted you to assemble because today I am not opposing anyone. I am proposing new ideas. I believe that Baltimore is in a place of change, that Baltimore County is in a place of transition, and Howard County is looking for new opportunities. My life experiences uniquely position me to represent the voices of the 7th Congressional District with a perspective on education, operating a successful charter school, Empowerment Academy, serving as an activist, a civil rights leader, and the pastor of the greatest church in the 7th District. And so let me say to my friends in neighborhoods and communities across this district that we do not need a leader that will just listen and not deliver. We do not need leadership that is going along to get along. We do not need a leader that just wants a title but does not understand what it means to serve. I submit myself telling you that I hear your cry. I hear your frustration. And Dr. King said, anybody can be great because anybody can serve.
Okay, that's the 44-year-old Jamal Bryant, pastor of the 12,000-member Empowerment Temple, announcing that he's going to run for that congressional seat.
Wow. Well, you have to have a base.
Yeah, and he has a base. Very popular guy, very well known. But he's also running against an 11-term incumbent who's also very popular, also very well known. So
and to whom he said, you're really a good congressman.
Yeah.
He congratulated him.
This gets a little strange, see, because we didn't expect to see Elijah Cummings being challenged in a Democratic primary by anybody who, you know, could possibly challenge him, right? Who had a chance. You might say Jamal Bryant might have a chance at that seat if Elijah Cummings doesn't run for it. So this is where it gets interesting.
Well, I must say, Dan, that this is the first time I've heard call and response used in the announcement of a candidacy.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounded like it came from the pulpit. I don't think it actually did. But so what's he up to? I mean, I think that's what everybody wants to know. I mean, particularly if, you know, he had nice things to say about Cummings.
Right.
So what's he really trying to do? I think what he's trying to do is find out what Elijah's going to do.
Yes, because he's hunching that Elijah Cummings is going to run for the Senate seat being vacated at the end of the next election cycle by Barbara Mikulski. Now, two members of Congress are already vying in the Democratic primary for that seat. That's Chris Van Hollen and Donna Edwards. But there's been all this talk for months that Elijah Cummings was going to run for that seat.
Well, the talk was there, but I think from the very beginning, people were saying he's probably not going to do that. He would change the dynamic of the race. He might actually be a winner in that race. Could very well be. But he'd end up being, what number senator would he be? 99? And he's got a much higher ranking than that in the House.
House Oversight Committee.
He's a force in the House.
He is. Now,
he's a go-to guy there.
Now, Jamal Bryant has said that all of my indicators and my intel, which is short for intelligence, says that Cummings is going to run for the Senate. So he was asked what he would do in the event that Cummings doesn't do that and runs for re-election in the 7th District.
You'll run against him even if he doesn't run for Senate?
I have not talked to him. I don't know what his plans are. I think that he has an incredible opportunity in front of him, and I pray that he does it, but that's a decision that that he would have to make. But if he decided not to, because he's been such an abiding presence in my life, if he decided to stay in, I would have a conversation with him because I respect him that much.
He said he would not commit to challenge Cummings should the lawmakers seek re-election, that he would have a conversation with him. This is from John Fritzi's story in the Baltimore Sun. Right. I represent a new generation that's coming forward, this whole movement of activists that are emerging nationwide. I think that Elijah Cummings has laid a tremendous foundation of success to build on. So it's kind of hard to sort this out a little bit, isn't it? It's not clear that he would actually challenge Elijah Cummings.
It's not clear. And I think most of us would guess that he wouldn't do that. I mean, you know, you would think, for example, that he would have had some professional help here, that he might actually have done a poll to see if what he thinks his intelligence tells him is true is actually true. I don't think anybody else thinks that there's any weakness at all in Cummings. Do you? I mean, electorally?
Do I think Jamal Bryant could beat Elijah Cummings in a primary? Are you asking me?
Yeah.
I say no, but he would make it interesting. It would be surprising. It would be a surprising thing to see in the city if that happened.
I think so, too. But as people have pointed out, it's not just the city. It goes out into the two counties.
Two counties, Howard County and Baltimore County.
Right.
So an interesting story. Got a little confusing there for me. And Jamal Bryant was invited to be on the show today, and we had him all set up to do an interview with him yesterday, and he canceled on us. So maybe he doesn't want to say anything more about this until we hear from Elijah Cummings. Next story. Republicans had another debate. What night was that? Wednesday night. Frazier stayed up to watch. Did you watch both debates? The cocktail hour debate and then the other one?
No, I didn't. I just saw
prime time.
I saw part A.
Okay. Impressions. Please share your thoughts.
To some extent, it was reassuring, I think. You know, people have referred to it as the clown car of the Republican primary. Yeah. And I think because the leading clown has been Donald Trump, and many people think he can't possibly go beyond where he is. But he's also sort of, as they say, sucked all the oxygen out of the room, and you really haven't had much of an opportunity to focus on the others. And I think you did get that because Trump was a little, and others have said this, a little withdrawn, seemed to be sort of whack-a-mole down into where you would think he might be. And so you had a chance to listen to some of the others, and I think some of them were Carly Fiorina was quite good, I thought. I thought Marco Rubio was good and seemed to me to be kind of coming out of somewhat subdued performance in the earlier debate.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was true, really, and I think it was true of Jeb Bush. I think he did a pretty good job of sort of countering some of the things that that Trump had said about him.
Did you find the candidates fact-challenged in any way?
Well, I'm sure they were.
I bring that up because there's a really good New York Times editorial about the GOP debate, crazy talk at the Republican debate. And just they say that the candidates do not seem to live in a fact-based world where actions have consequences, where programs take money, and money has to come from somewhere, where basic laws like physics and the Constitution constrain wishes, where Congress and the public, allies and enemies, markets and militaries don't just do what you want them to just because you say they will. It's a good editorial. I posted it on my Facebook page if you want to find it quick.
Well, another way of dealing with what some people say about Trump, that actually, in his mind, he will say things like, I never made any effort to have casinos in Florida. And Bush is standing there looking very credible to me, saying, of course you did. You sent me money. You know, you wanted them. And you know, Trump is saying, no, I didn't. That's mm-hmm. just absolutely not true.
Who would you say was the star of this particular debate, if there was one? Was it Fiorini? Everybody, she seems to have created quite a buzz.
She was very impressive. I think she may have hurt herself a little bit by saying that, maybe a lot, by saying that she would refuse to talk to Putin. I mean, how do you become the spokesman for the United States in the free world and then start?
Didn't she say she would deploy a lot of troops there too, to Germany?
Oh yeah,
to beef everything up in Europe.
Well, she's
Western
going to
Europe.
Bring all of the services back to their optimal strength.
I wanted to ask you about a couple other things that are local. One has to do with Governor O'Malley, former Governor O'Malley, who is still running for president. We talked about this the other day with David Zerwick. He had a little trouble at the Diane Rehm show on Wednesday, showing up late and being chastised by the host of the Diane Rehm show.
He certainly was. He was caught in traffic. There was an accident, et cetera, et cetera, and she wasn't buying any of that. I mean, she said, you promised you would be on time, and he tried to make a joke by saying, well, Diane, you really can't trust promises of politicians.
Yeah.
And she didn't think it was very funny.
No, and she seemed to hold this attitude through the rest of the hour.
But, you know, it's too bad that kind of thing that's based in theater becomes the story, because he really was pretty good at telling the world, the radio world, where he stands.
You thought
on,
he mostly performed
issues.
Well. Answers were good on Diane Rehm.
I thought he did a very good job.
Okay. I heard some other comments about some of the other questions he was asked about Syria, about guns in America, where the person who described this to me, an editor of The Sun, didn't think he did so well on those two. But anyway.
I thought he did pretty well. May be some that he didn't. I'm not well-versed in all these issues. But, you know, it's interesting how the past can haunt you. I mean, he was pretty famous for never showing up on time for the Board of Public Works.
In Annapolis. Yeah.
As if it was okay for him to be late. And I think that's...
Maybe he got in the habit of that.
It's possible.
Fraser Smith, senior news analyst of WYPR, is going to stay with us in the studio as we take a little break here and come back. And speaking of Annapolis, Steve Hsu, the Anne Arundel County executive, saying he wants to ban something that is now legal in the state of Maryland, medical marijuana, the growing, processing, and dispensing of medical marijuana. We'll speak with Delegate Dan Morheim, sponsor of the legislation to legalize medical marijuana in Maryland, after this short break on Midday Friday. don't know. This week, Anne Arundel County Executive Steve Shue said he planned to introduce legislation that would ban the growth, processing, and dispensing of medical marijuana in the county. That's exactly what the state law allows. He cited public safety concerns, a potential for increased recreational use of marijuana, as some of his reasons. We wanted to hear from the other side on this. Delegate Dan Morheim has been on the side for legalization for quite a while. He's, of course, also a medical doctor who serves the 11th District of Baltimore County in the House of Delegates and sponsored legislation to legalize medical marijuana in the state. So, Dan Morheim, thank you very much for joining us.
Great to be with you.
I want to ask you specifically about a concern that Steve Shue raised, and that was he was concerned about the potential maximum amount of marijuana an individual could purchase under the law, suggesting that such a large amount, which may not be such a large amount, but sounds like a large amount, could possibly lead to, you know, the illegal sale of marijuana to other users. So let's talk about that for a moment, that concern of his.
Well, he has a number of concerns, all of which are unfounded and none of which have happened in any of the 23 states or the District of Columbia, which do have medical cannabis laws. And you can't take one piece of this bill, which passed the General Assembly, overwhelming bipartisan support, signed previously by Governor O'Malley and this year signed by Governor Hogan. You can't take that piece out and just look at it. But essentially, the dynamic is this. We allow doctors to make recommendations and on cannabis, and we allow doctors to prescribe medicine. And you just have to think of the recommendations of cannabis like a medical prescription. Doctors will, in prescribing, recommend amounts and dosages and routes of administration. It's more limited in the cannabis world, but in no state which has medical cannabis of any of the problems that he alleges to have happened take place. It's also important to note that in Anne Arundel County, the 20 Anne Arundel County delegates and senators of them, 18 voted for the bill and only 2 voted against. And that includes House Republican Minority Leader Nick Kipke and Speaker Mike Bush. One more point on this issue. In studies, these are peer-reviewed published studies, in states that have medical cannabis programs, adolescent use stays the same or actually decreases. And when that information was brought to the General Assembly, and many of the members shared these concerns, they realized that this was a concern, but there was a real good answer to it, namely that medical cannabis use does not lead to increased use by adolescents or anybody else. So facts speak differently than what County Executive Shue wants to choose to believe.
Okay. And just for our listeners, his point of concern was that the somebody who is certified for medical marijuana can purchase up to 120 grams, about a quarter pound, over a 30-day period. And I spoke with Hannah Byron, who is the chairman of the commission, the Medical Cannabis Commission in the state, and she said that would likely be for a terminal cancer patient seeking to relieve pain.
You can't extrapolate, you know, one thing there. You have to leave room for different amounts. But a child with seizures may just be getting a few drops under their tongue once or twice a day. Someone who's in a hospice dying of cancer may get something else. Somebody who's in the middle of cancer chemotherapy for a short period of time may benefit from other routes of administration or other amounts. And somebody who has multiple sclerosis and uses medical cannabis, which is the correct term, by the way, for this discussion, cannabis, may use medical cannabis intermittently. One other point, if anybody, and this has been overlooked, in our law, if anybody breaks the medical cannabis law, they're subject to severe penalties and jail, much more so than just dealing marijuana on the street. Mm. We took the position that this is like a sacred trust, this using medical cannabis. And so if you do break the law by diverting medical cannabis, and there are tight controls every step of the way, then you're going to suffer more. You're going to suffer more severe penalties than otherwise. And that's another part of the bill. You know, we do have a saying in Annapolis, when in doubt, read the bill. And legislators read the bill very carefully. And, you know, a topic like this is a high-profile topic. Wouldn't have passed with votes on the order of 175 to 10 out of 188 legislators or of that order for 3 years running if their concerns, which are legitimate, weren't addressed. Unfortunately, County Executive Shue hasn't taken a close look at the facts or maybe a close look at the bill.
Fraser Smith is here and has a question for you, Dan Morheim.
Delegate Morheim, good to speak with you. I just wonder what the practical effect of one county executive doing this would be. Would it just inconvenience the people in his county so they have to go elsewhere to buy this? Or what do you say to that?
Well, it's exactly what it'll do. First of all, the county council, as I understand Anne Arundel County, has to act on this, and so far a number of them have expressed reservations. It's up to the citizens of Anne Arundel County to let their county council members know that this is a poor idea. Yes, it will simply inconvenience Anne Arundel County residents who are sick people seeking help for their ailments and their diseases, have to drive farther away to get it, because other counties are figuring out rational plans to deal with a responsible and judicious bill that's just going to help thousands of people. We estimate somewhere between 50 and 80,000 at any given time. So, and it polls at about 90% in the public in Maryland. So I think it just, yes, it will just be harsh for Anne Arundel County residents, and it's up to them to voice their concerns.
Okay. Dan Morheim, thank you very much for your time.
Great. Thanks to be with you both.
That's,
take care.
Delegate Dan Morheim of Baltimore County is sponsor of the legislation that legalized medical marijuana. I'll continue to call it that. You can call it cannabis, too. I think the words are interchangeable. The state now is taking applications from potential growers and processors and dispensers. Once awarded, a limited number of each of those operations, growing, dispensing, processing, is expected to begin sometime in the middle of next year. Now joining us in the studio again is Rick Seltzer, I'm happy to say, reporter from the Baltimore Business Journal, today's edition of the BBJ. Rick has a cover story about Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake and her final 15 months in office, since it was a week ago today. Fraser Smith and Rick Seltzer. Rick, nice to see you.
Good to see you, too. Thanks for having me.
Just a week ago today that she announced that she was not running for re-election. Just maybe touch on this a little bit, the cover story. The mayor feels... Would she lay out some priorities for the 15 months?
Sure. We wanted to talk to her specifically about what she wants to do on the business side of things. There are a lot of different development projects in the line on the city side right now, and she laid out some of the things she wants to do. Many of them are things you've heard before. In fact, I didn't hear a huge departure from any economic policy, which in and of itself is probably noteworthy. There are some economists who and others in the business community who said by not running, she has a chance to really kind of take a step away from what she's done if she wants, or do things without worrying about political ramifications. I heard that over and over again as I talked to people. One thing that was pitched as an idea was maybe try to bring in more private capital as if this changes her ability to do that. But I can't get into whether or not it really does change her ability to do that. I just know she told me some of her priorities. There are things like the public market overhauls that you've heard of, Lexington Market and Cross Street, which are in various stages of negotiations with developments. Some small business initiatives, boost the city's small business resource center, try to get grocery stores into food desert areas. And then one project I think that's been in the city's pipeline for a long time is it was formerly known as the Superblock. It's that chunk of properties. It's 27 properties there at Fayette, Lexington, Howard.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Just went out on an RFP. They're looking for developers. They're open to breaking it up now. And not doing it as one giant project, which is what it was going to be before when it was tied up for years and years in the courts. Now that it's out of the court system, maybe we'll see some movement on that.
Your colleague Sarah Meehan had a couple of stories this week about Under Armour. Under Armour makes a lot of news. It seems like every day, several hours out of each day. First, they had their investor day where Kevin Plank, I guess, laid out his plans for the future campus of Under Armour in South Baltimore at Port Covington.
That's right. The future campus in Port Covington, some of the first new renderings that we've seen of this. It's going to be a pretty substantial redevelopment. Kevin Plank's been spending millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars buying up acres of land there. I think actually the first 600 employees are going to relocate there. I think they're on the financial side into what's going to be a repurposed Sam's Club building in January of 2016. Now, after that, I think you're going to see some substantial transformations still happening. I'm not great at describing architecture, but I recommend checking out the renderings on our website if you can. There's some, you know, arcing roofs, kind of that Under Armour architecture you're used to, and of course the giant logos everywhere.
Yeah, and wind turbines.
Wind turbines?
It kind of looks like a green campus.
The area is also supposed to have Kevin Plank's distillery, I believe, too.
A whiskey distillery, and I believe they're building a new barn for the Baltimore City Mounted Police horses.
Yeah, it's everything and everything going in there. Should be interesting.
Innovation labs, sporting fields, of course, fitness centers, of course, manufacturing facilities. So I circled that, that phrase, manufacturing facilities, to that begs further inquiry. Public parks and green spaces. And then another story Sarah had, Under Armour. Look at this headline, Frazier. You like this headline? Under Armour expects revenue to double to $7.5 billion by 2018. Do you want to comment on that, Rick?
Or that is a very, very large jump.
It is.
3 years, and you're talking about $3.8 billion or so in revenue today, up to $7.5 billion. That would make Under Armour a Fortune 500 company based on measurements today. The Baltimore area hasn't had one of those since Exelon bought Constellation three years ago.
Right.
So, you know, that's something on the prestige end of things, just having a Fortune 500 company again. And, of course, having a bigger company means having a bigger employer in the area. I do want to throw just a little bit of perspective on this, though. A $7.5 billion company is huge compared to what we have based in Baltimore now. But look at market leader like Nike.
Nike, yeah.
They make more than $7.5 billion in a quarter. Or, I'm sorry, they sell more than $7.5 billion in a quarter. So there's still some room, I think, on the athletic sales for Under Armour to go, even if they hit that point.
Natty Bo just got even less Baltimore. I didn't think that could happen, but it actually has happened. Because I thought Natty Bo was already sort of not so much Baltimore anymore. So what's going on here? There's a Russian company involved now, right?
The Russian company, actually, I believe there was a Russian investor who led a group to buy Pabst, which owns Natty Bo. There's a lot of someone owning someone in this story. But actually, I believe the holding company is now going to stay based in America, is what they said.
Okay.
But what's happening now this week, interestingly enough, is so Natty Bo is owned by Pabst, but it's brewed by Miller Coors under a contract.
It hasn't been brewed in Baltimore for
15 years or so.
At least 15 years?
Okay. That's right. It's right. Brewed right now in Eden, North Carolina.
It tastes pretty good, though.
But, well, the brewery where it's brewing is closing, so hopefully it'll keep tasting pretty good to you. They're going to close it next year, and Pabst did confirm to me they're going to keep brewing the beer. So apparently Baltimore and Maryland, where like 90% of its sales are, is enough to keep the label going. But the question is, where will it be brewed now? Not quite sure, but one place it was thrown out there is Miller Coors Brewery in Elkton, Virginia. So Natty Bo actually might be getting a little closer to home.
Yeah.
Closer to home and farther away at the same time, if you count that ownership change.
Have you had a Natty Bo, Frazier, in the last year?
No, I have not.
It's pretty good. I think I have a new respect for Natty Bo. Look at Luke in Luke Spicknell, our director in there, nodding.
Luke would
he lit right up when I mentioned Natty Bo. Did you see him in there?
I like to call it everyone's favorite local beer that's brewed out of state.
Right, it is. It is.
And, I love the logo. I mean,
yeah,
it's almost as exciting as the Under Armour logo.
The Under Armour thing is kind of amazing, isn't it?
Oh, it is.
I don't mean just the growth of the company. I mean what Kevin Plank's trying to do here is commitment to the city. It's,
well, I'm sitting here wondering about, you know, that recent burst of interest that he had in economic development and talking about Baltimore with a chip on its shoulder, which I don't think is exactly correct. But at any rate, you know, you wonder when he is accumulating all this power what his thoughts might be about, you know, leadership.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I didn't understand the metaphor that he used about having a chip on our shoulder.
I didn't either.
I thought what he was trying to say was that we have low self-esteem here. We need to think of ourselves in bigger terms.
I think that's true.
And this was before the riot, by the way. This was before Freddie Gray, right?
Yes, it was.
That interview was from earlier in the year.
Yeah. Well, the chip on, I mean, the low self-esteem thing has been around for a long time. I don't know if that's even true anymore, but I think it was true when, you know, Sparrow's Point closed and Schaefer became the mayor, and that was his whole
coming
basic
out of
thrust
the last
for
riot,
years.
1968.
Right, exactly.
And also Kevin Plank's hotel in Fells Point, they're still at work on that too, right, with the old rec pier.
Yes, I believe work has started on demolishing the rec pier. I haven't been by it lately, but it should be underway, still going.
Oh, definitely. A lot of work going on. I've seen it in the last week or so. There's a lot of work going on down there.
Rick Seltzer from the Baltimore Business Journal with the weekly business report. Thank you very much for being here. Again, the cover story features Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake. Beat the clock. The mayor has lots to do in her final months. Economic development may flounder as she tackles the city's challenges. That's the question. That's the cover story in print. The imprint edition of the BBJ. Thank you, Rick.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you, Frazier. We're going to take a break here. When we get back, Paula Gallagher from the Baltimore County Public Library joining us to talk about some books. And Chris Reed, our film critic, will review two movies. So please stay tuned. And we're back. It's midday Friday. Paula Gallagher joining us again. Paula from the Pikesville branch of the Baltimore County Library joins us from time to time to recommend books. Tell us about the books that she's been reading that have been arriving at the library. Now, this time, hello, Paula.
Hi, Dan.
Nice to see you.
Good to see you.
This time, the books that you're discussing are in advance of the Small Book Expo, which I wasn't aware of until you told me about it. Is it? It's held every year in Bethesda, the same place?
Yeah, it's actually the Small Press Expo. Or,
what did I say?
Small Book, I think.
Small Press.
Small Press Expo, or SPX. This is the 21st annual SPX, and it takes place Saturday and Sunday at the Bethesda Marriott and Conference Center. And it's a convention that brings together comic artists from throughout the United States, people who do either panel strips or online comics or graphic novels or sometimes all of the above. And they have everything from people who are just getting started in the industry to people who are recognizable names.
And do you go to this event each year?
It's something I absolutely look forward to. It's a highlight of my fall season.
Tell us why, though. Are you there as a scout for the library or just out of your own interest?
A little bit of both. I do scout for things for the library. Baltimore County is a great system in that we have a good budget and we buy a lot of graphic novels. So anybody who's interested in trying this medium who hasn't doesn't necessarily want to invest the money. The library is a great place to get the latest. So sure, I'm looking for that. But they have some great workshops and panels, so I get some professional education out of going down. And I get to find, you know, artists that I didn't know about before and storytellers that are new to me, and it's very exciting. And to meet these people face-to-face and actually talk to them is great.
Have libraries traditionally stocked graphic novels, or is that a relatively new thing?
Well, you know, I think since the inception of graphic novels, libraries were always early adopters. We've been librarians for a long time have been championing this medium as something to take seriously. It's, you know, well past the time when we used to think they were comic books. We're way past that. And we know they're just a different way to tell the story. They're a different way to read. They're very engrossing. They're often a good way to hook people who don't normally read. And sometimes those are kids, too.
Yeah, I think they're great. I love them. I just wondered whether they're maybe not in this part of the country, other parts of the country, resistance to that, thinking of them as a book that belongs in the library.
I think a lot of that has disappeared in the last several years.
And a question about the term, if you don't mind, graphic novel. So, because one of the books, actually two of the books you're talking about today, are based, one wholly on truth and one at least in part on truth. One is considered sort of a memoir novel. But the term graphic novel applies to something that's a story that's nonfiction that's given this artist treatment.
Yes, and it can be a little misleading when you hear graphic novel because we're used to novels being fiction. And if you look just even on the spine of one of these I brought today from the library, we classified it says on the spine label graphic novel, but it has a Dewey Nut decimal call number in the nonfiction in the area where you would find radio. This one is about radio. And the other that we have is my own copy, but this will have in graphic novels listed in graphic novel bio will be the spine label
graphic
for that.
Graphic novel bio. Okay. Yes. You want to talk about that one first? Because actually, that artist is the most famous one of the three that you selected, I think. This is Bill Griffith. A lot of people will know as the creator of Zippy the Pinhead.
Exactly. He's the most famous when it comes to the mainstream America. People know his absurdist strip, Zippy the Pinhead. This time, though, he's examining his own life, and this is a departure for him. He's talking about his family and his growing up, and the story starts when we see him in present day, or a couple years ago. He's gotten an actual letter from his Uncle Al, and you see him in the panels marveling about getting a letter. It's not the internet. It's an actual written letter. And Uncle Al says, I've got this box of family memorabilia, letters, pictures, and I thought you would be interested. And so he decides to take a trip. And so this is how the story is framed. And, you know, Bill Griffith did not have a great childhood. He grew up in Levittown, Pennsylvania in the 50s and 60s. His father was military and very cold, distant guy, and in fact, very physically abusive to him and his sister. And he talks about, you know, their mother didn't intervene. She was not herself abused, at least physically, but it just went on. But then he found out after his father died, she confided in him and told him that she herself had a love of her life, and it was a man she'd been having an affair with for the last 16 years.
And that's what the book is called?
The book is called Invisible Ink. It's my mother's secret love affair with a famous cartoonist. So ironically, the man that she was having the affair with...
Was a cartoonist?
Exactly. Now, this guy was not someone who was in Bill Griffith's consciousness. He was a guy who was a crime writer. He wrote, you know, kind of... He was kind of a hack. He wrote crime fiction. He wrote... he did all of these strips and how to draw comics. And, you know, so Bill Griffith also gets to muse, what would his life have been like had he known this man, and had this man mentored him, what would his style have looked like? And he plays around with that in the panels that he draws here. So it's really great. You get pulled in. The strips are very, the pages in the book are very realistic. However, he draws himself in kind of a cartoony way, removing himself a little bit from the action.
Every page, a cartoon. Every page.
Right. Everything is a comic strip. In some of them, he's drawing the cover. He's drawing from a photo of his mother. So very realistic looking.
In the second hour of the show today, we're going to be talking about the history of radio. So I thought it was ironic that you brought this book in. This is called Out on the Wire. This is a very interesting story, the odyssey of this book. This is, again, the graphic novel. This one by Jessica Abel?
Yes.
It's called Out on the Wire, The Storytelling Secrets of the New Masters of Radio, referring here mainly to public radio, right?
Yeah. And, you know, when I came across this book, I thought this is a shoe-in to talk about on your show and to talk about it preceding an hour on radio. Cartoonist and writer Jessica Abel has written her own graphic novel, and she's also done textbooks on the writing of graphic novels. And so back in 1999, she... her work caught the attention of Ira Glass of This American Life. And he contacted her and convinced her that she should try radio comics. So he gave her this idea. And they did a pamphlet together about how specifically This American Life is put together from inception of from idea to working that into a story. And it was actually published, and it was sent out to NPR supporters. And so that was the germ of the seed that became this book, although it's many years later, and you'll see that excerpted in this book. But it's very interesting, because I think graphic novels have the ability to pull you into a story, unlike prose and pictures themselves can do on their own. It's a different way. And you'll notice in the early early pamphlet that's in there, it's very straightforward. People talking, speech balloons, and what they're saying about the show. And then as you get further into the book, and she's developed as an artist, she does some very other interesting, imaginative things with the panels to bring you into the story and bring you into what they're telling you about the process.
And it's not just This American Life, but also Radio Lab is featured in here.
Yes, and Planet Money.
And Planet Money.
And The Moth, and a couple of others as well.
Interesting idea. Well, you know, our listeners are probably like this book.
Anybody who likes NPR, it's a fantastic gift book, and it's not something that you're going to be done with in a couple of days. It's really something you'll pour over. You wouldn't think of that as a topic for graphic novel, but she does a brilliant job.
Now, the next one Paula wants to talk about is The Diary of a Teenage Girl, described as a hybrid graphic, this is what I meant before, graphic novel memoir, right?
Exactly. So this one actually, interestingly enough, was first published in 2002. And the artist author is Phoebe Glockner. And Phoebe is really, it's not purely fiction either. She's drawing on her own coming of age, adolescence, back in the 1970s in San Francisco. And so her main character is not herself. It's a young girl named Minnie. Minnie Goetz, and she is 15, and she's coming into her body, she's developed, she's becoming sexual, she's trying to figure out who she is. She's got a very sort of liberal, hippie, librarian mother and a pesky younger sister. There's no dad around, but there is mom's boyfriend, and therein lies one of the interesting things about this book, which has been criticized as much as it has been celebrated. Glockner's got these great panels drawing Minnie. She's including panels that she says Minnie herself is drawing. She's saying she's a budding cartoonist. She is a protege of Aileen Kaminsky, R. Crumb's cartoonist mm-hmm. wife. And so she is attracted to her mother's boyfriend. And so there becomes this seductive dance between the two. And he is her object of lust and ultimately the guy she sleeps with and continues an affair with. And it's uneasy and uncomfortable.
Let me just say this about the three books that you're describing today, you recommend these books
absolutely.
For people who like graphic novels.
Yes.
Right?
Well, and for people
even
who,
if you don't.
Yeah. Or even for anyone who's never picked up a graphic novel,
Paula,
any of these
right.
would be good.
My point is, you're not just here to tell us about some interesting books that came across your desk. These are books that you liked and think are
yes,
very good.
Yes. And I picked them also because all of these artists are going to be appearing at Small Press Expo over this weekend. Each of them is the subject of their own panel and interview, and you'll be able to hear them and even ask questions, meet them, sign, do a signing with them.
The Diary of a Teenage Girl was made into a movie. Chris Reed is here to review some films. Not that one, but you did like that movie, as I recall.
I did very much. It was actually the subject of an entire segment on my TV show, Real Talk, that I do for Dragon Digital Media. And both I and my guest were big fans of the film. It's uncomfortable as well, like the graphic novel. In some sense, more uncomfortable because you see this actress who looks all of 15, though she's 23, standing naked in front of a mirror and then engaging in this affair with a much older man. But I think it is a both book and film are great works of feminist art.
And Paula, did you get to see the film?
I did, and I actually took my almost 15-year-old daughter. And it was as interesting to watch the movie as to realize how uncomfortable it was making me. And looking at her, and we walked out, and she kind of used an expletive as we walked out. And so I thought, I'm not going to talk to her tonight. And the next morning, I said, well, I'm sorry if you didn't like it. And she said, I did not say I didn't like it. And she didn't really want to talk too much about it. And I found that interesting. But it was clear that it was a lot to think about. And that's what I like to do, too. I like film that makes you think.
Have you ever had a conversation with her since then about the film?
Yeah. Actually, yeah, we have. And we've made some jokes about it. And sometimes that's the way to deal with it.
Paula Gallagher, thank you very much for doing that today.
Thank you,
introducing
Dan.
Us to those three graphic novels. Chris Reed is here. I'm sorry, did you want to say?
Oh, I just wanted to remind your listeners that they can go to Between the Covers on BCPL's website, and there'll be a blog post with more about all of these books on there, reviews of them by myself.
Thanks for that reminder.
Thank
That's
you.
The blog that Paula contributes to for the Baltimore County Public Library. So, Chris Reed, nice to see you again, Chris.
Great to be here as always, Dan.
Now, Everest. Gee whiz, what can you say about this? I've heard all kinds of things about this film, so I'm interested to hear what you have to say.
It's a pretty intense film. Actually, both films that opened today that I'm reviewing, Everest and Black Mass, both feature large ensemble casts. In the case of Everest, I would say the ensemble cast is probably a little too large because no one character emerges as our main focus. But in terms of a film that showcases the dangers and the brutal quality of the elements on the world's highest peak, Everest is a really visceral cinematic experience filmed in IMAX 3D. In this case, I think both of those formats help that part of the story because with the IMAX screen, you have these wide vistas. With 3D, you have that extra dimensionality of the screen, which really helps sell the idea of the mountain's size. And in particular, sell the most interesting part of the film, which is how it shows the dangers of over-commercialization of extreme sports. Because one part of the reason why people die in this movie, this is about the 1996 ill-fated expedition up Everest that John Krakauer profiled in Into Thin Air.
Into Thin Air.
One of the reasons why people die is because there are just too many people on the mountain, or at least that's what the filmmakers say. There are too many people on the mountain, which leads experienced guides to make bad decisions. So it's a film that is, on one hand, extremely powerful, and on the other hand, a little flat, because with this large ensemble cast, none of the stories, for me, really stood out. And also, at the end of the day, this is telling a story of a group of people who voluntarily decided to engage in this extremely dangerous activity, which for me somewhat mitigates the tragedy. I'm not saying
right.
that people on screen dying is
I
not moving, but
right.
it's their choice to climb the mountain.
But the first point, though, about there being too many people, too many characters, right? And no one particular one that you focus on and empathize with.
Some people might disagree, but I felt like the moments of tragedy were not as earned as they might have been were we focusing on one character.
Okay.
So I have a clip from the film, and this is Jason Clark, who plays the nominal star of the movie, Rob Hall, the man who invented commercial climbing of Mount Everest and who perished in 1996. Not a plot spoiler, well-known fact. And here he is describing to the people who have arrived, his clients, who've paid upwards of $65,000 to climb the mountain. He's explaining to them sort of the dangers of climbing Mount Everest.
Those of you who dare face their dreams, Venture Consultants offers something beyond the power of words to describe. And why don't we describe it in the brochure?
Because it's mostly just pain.
Yes.
Ain't that the truth?
Put it simply, guys.
Human beings simply aren't built to function at the cruising altitude of a 747. Okay, once we get above here, above the South Col, our bodies will be literally dying, and I mean literally dying. It's not called the death zone for nothing, guys. So the game is, can we get you up to the top and down to the bottom before that happens?
Does the IMAX experience, the 3D IMAX, make up for the flaws you might see in the character development?
I think that will depend on the viewer. I definitely found the film very thrilling and exciting at times. There's no question that the format serves that part of the story. And what's interesting is that in 1996, at the same time that Rob Hall and his crew were preparing to climb the mountain, there was an actual IMAX crew on site filming the 1998 documentary that traveled through IMAX theaters and science museums called, as well, Everest.
Huh.
And they briefly mentioned that crew. Now, they were just filming in IMAX, not IMAX 3D.
Black Mass. This is the story of Whitey Bulger in Boston?
That's right. James Whitey Bulger,
yeah.
Older brother of Billy Bulger, who for a long time was president of the Massachusetts Senate. What a family.
Right.
And this is another large ensemble cast. You know, Kevin Bacon shows up, Adam Scott. We've got Joel Edgerton. We have, of course, Johnny Depp as James Whitey Bulger. And it's a film that, like Everest, does some things very well. It's very visceral to see James Whitey Bulger, notorious Boston gangster, head of the Winter Hill Gang starting in the late 70s, sort of the Irish mafia of Boston that helped the FBI take down the Italian mafia. It's very visceral to watch him be as violent as he was known to be. If you like your mob killings in your face, people strangled, shot, blood spattering the camera, this is a movie for you. Now, a lot has been said about how unrecognizable Johnny Depp is in this movie. And so, in some sense, I think the people who deserve the real kudos for the film are his makeup artist, his dialect coach, and his blue contact lenses. Linda DeLibero, my colleague, mentioned that it makes him look a little bit like Ray Liotta. But I thought he was quite fine. I don't think the character or the performance is that nuanced. I don't think the film is that nuanced. I think it's very interesting in how it shows the collusion between the FBI agent played by Joel Edgerton and Johnny Depp's James Whitey Bulger. And if we have time for a clip, this is that very moment where you hear Joel Edgerton selling the idea of collaboration with the FBI to Whitey Bulger.
You got 2 minutes.
I'm going to come right to it. I have it on very good authority that Gennaro Angiulo is planning to have you murdered.
Is that so? And how does he plan to achieve that?
That's the kind of information that my side gets. And that's the kind of information that we can provide.
John, do you know what I do to Rand?
It ain't Rand, Jimmy. It's an alliance.
An alliance between me and the FBI?
No, between you and me. I can help you, Jimmy, and you can help me. I'm not trying to clean up Southie. I love this place. I'm interested in the North End. I'm interested in the Mafia, and I bet you are too.
That's 2 minutes.
I'm going to be a sucker for that one.
I
think so.
You know, individual scenes are quite exciting.
Yeah.
I just don't think it's...
As a whole.
I don't think as a whole it's as interesting as a documentary that came out last year called Whitey, United States of America versus James
good.
Bulger.
Yeah,
now, that
it.
Was a phenomenal film. This is not quite up to that level, but that was a documentary.
Before I let you go, M. Night...
Shyamalan.
Is that how you pronounce it?
Yes.
Thank you. M. Night Shyamalan. I always wondered what happened to him because he kind of disappeared for a few years.
Well, he disappeared only because his films were panned by critics and then they began to also be unsuccessful at the box office. So he made After Earth was his last film before this, which tanked with Will Smith and his son Jaden. But he's back. His film was number two, basically tied for number one last week at the box office.
It's called The Visit.
The Visit. It's not a film that I wholly admire, but it has good things to it. So if you want a horror film on the weekend, I say you could do worse than see The Visit, though it is very anti-old people, so keep that in mind.
Chris Reed joins us once a month for Midday on Film from time to time to review films. He'll be back again in 2 weeks. Thanks very much, Chris.
Thanks, Dan.
Joe Squared Pizza providing lunch for our guests today. Joe Squared located at 133 West North Avenue for now, but they're moving. They're in Station North. They're going to stay in Station North. They're also at the Inner Harbor at Power Plant Live, and you can find them on the web at joesquared.com. Please stay tuned for the news and then the second hour of Midday Friday.